You're listening to AGR, Alabama Guard Radio, the official podcast of the Alabama National Guard. I'm Staff Sergeant Jacob Hearn, and with me today is Sergeant Megan Terry.
We couldn't be more excited to have Major Eric be here with us today. He's someone who started at the bottom of the ranks and rose his way up, navigating through self-doubt and difficult challenges while overcoming the most difficult schools that the Army has to offer. But what's interesting is you'll never guess where he started.
I was 17 years old. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, which I think is most 17-year-olds. But I just figured I'd do what everybody else did. After you graduate high school, you go to college and then job and pay off all your debts and then get married and then have a dog and, you know, white picket fence. At some point, that magic would just happen. And then it kind of changed. I was 17. My brother is 17 months older than I am. He crushed the ACT and SATs. He is a very smart guy. So smart that he should wear like Velcro shoes, you know, because he might forget to tie them. I've saved his life on multiple occasions by stopping him from reading a book while crossing the street. But he had a free ride to college. And I remember my dad asked me, so what are you going to do? And it's funny because like my dad has always had like this mantra of like, you can do anything you want to do. When you turn 18, you just can't do it here. It's like, you can leave my house at 18. That's what you can do. And that's, I mean, it sounds funny now, but when you hear it at every birthday since you were 3 years old, that's pretty impactful. And eventually you just, I'm Peter Pan. I'll never grow up. But then I was like, hey, you know, Dad, I thought Grandma passed away and she left me like college money stuff. He's like, oh yeah, son, come here. He's like, you see that big screen TV? See those hardwood floors? He's like, thanks, college fund. So I started looking around and I was like, okay. You know, I grew up on Clint Eastwood movies and John Wayne and the Green Berets and Rambo. And I was like, I'll go join the Army. Walked into an Army recruiter's office, and I was like, hey, I was like, what's the hardest thing in the Army? And I knew about Special Forces very vaguely, but I was like, I'll never be able to do that. He was like, Army Ranger, and I was like, awesome, I want to do that. And he just looked at me up and down, he's like, do you know you're fat? And I was like, yes, I'm well aware. But, you know, for context, this is prior to 9/11. You know, the recruiting effort wasn't there. The incentives weren't there. It was just like, yeah, you can be an Army Ranger, but not you can't be an Army Ranger.
So yeah, Eric persisted. He took his ASVAB, got top scores. Recruiters said he could have done anything he wanted in the military.
But unfortunately, Eric was still struggling with his weight, and none of the active duty components would recruit a kid who had that high of a percentage of body fat. So Eric decided to go talk to a National Guard recruiter.
And I went over to the guard, and they're like, yeah, we're full of fat guys. Come on over. And that's joking. But he said, no, he's like, here's your opportunities. You can do whatever you want. But I was under the perception that I had to get into the unit that was where I live. I joined a field artillery unit in the town that I was in at the time, you know? And so I joined field artillery. I had to actually, because I was 17, I had to get my dad to sign off on the paperwork. I went down and my recruiter's like, all right, listen, I've talked to a lot of parents. You know, I know how to talk to them. All right, let me just take care of everything. So I went to my dad's office and we went inside. My dad looked at me, he looked at the recruiter, and he's like, all right, where do I sign? I was like, man, you are good. That was a short speech of here's the paperwork.
Cool. Eric was in. He had his paperwork, his ASVAB scores, and a spot in a combat arms unit. All he had to do now was get through MEPS.
The Military Entrance Processing Station is the last obstacle that recruits need to get into the military. Eric was still nervous, however, because MEPS could still disqualify him for being too overweight, so he needed to figure out how he was going to get past that obstacle.
I get in there. It was actually a Navy corpsman. I was getting ready to leave, and he's like, do you know you are too fat to be in the Army? And I was like, I mean, I thought that I would lose weight. And he's like, check it out. You have to be a certain percentage of body fat just for me to sign off on these papers. And you're not close. He said, you would have to lose about 15 pounds just to go to basic training. He's like, but if you can do 10 push-ups right now and show me you want to go, I will sign off on this paper. It kind of started to hit me. Especially as I got down to try to do 10 push-ups, which I struggled with mightily, that I was really not in very good shape to join the military. And then everybody I knew who I thought would be proud of my decision was like, why would you do that? Like, you are not going to make it. That Navy corpsman who didn't know me was the first person that actually was like, all right, show me you want to do this. And I was like, that's what I'll do. I will at least have, I'll put in the effort to stop being fat and lazy and stop doubting myself and at least just try. At least I'll try. I shipped to basic training, and then I met the next person who was going to believe in me more than I believed in me, and that was my drill sergeant. And he was not about positive affirmation. He didn't tell me every day, like, all right, young man, you can do it. I just need you to try hard today. No, he used the tough love approach, and he absolutely yelled at me and called me all the most foul names, told me I was fat and I was just going to have to do more with less, more runs, more PT, more yelling. But the thing he never did was told me I couldn't be a soldier, never recommended that I be removed from basic training. All he did was tell me to run faster, push harder. And that's what it was. It's like sometimes you need somebody to push you beyond where you think you can go. And that was the first time that had ever happened for me. And I was like, man, I can do a lot more than I thought I could. So to kind of sum it up, I lost 15 pounds just to make weight to go to basic training. And then at basic training, on my first PT test, I did 11 push-ups, 12 sit-ups, and ran a 24:46 2-mile. Then over the next several months, I lost 40 pounds. And then I finished up basic training doing 46 push-ups, 58 sit-ups, and running a 14:46.
So Eric joined pre-9/11, but while he was in basic training is actually when the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center. What's crazy about his telling is that him and his fellow soldiers in training weren't told what had happened. And when someone finally explained that something was going on, they kept things pretty vague.
And finally, a couple of days later, you know, our battalion commander came down. He was like a little snivelly guy, and he had big glasses. He's like, all right, guys, just to let you know, there was an incident. An incident occurred. It was a catastrophic incident. You know, it was real bad. And, you know, America's, we're figuring it out, you know, and some things are happening, and the military will probably be involved. And we're like, what is going on? And then, you know, he walked off, and our first sergeant got out there. And the first sergeant was the first guy I'd ever seen with a combat patch. So I'd actually been overseas. He had been in. Jumped into Just Cause, Ranger Regiment. I can't recall. But huge dude, always spoke at the same volume, but it wasn't like if you were close to him or you were in the back of the formation, you always heard him with the same level. And he was like, all right, men, we've been hit. And I swear that the American flag is going to be flying high over some third world dirt hole, and we're going to get them. And we're like, ah! We all went out and ran 3 miles. And I was like, you know, basic training is where I kind of started to become, like, I acculturated into, like, the military mentality. I liked the people I was with. And it was people from all walks of life, all across the country. And it was like, we all had to go through this hardship together. Now, we also all thought that they told every basic training class they were going to war. Like, this is something that they did to everybody. And it wasn't actually till like months later, I was on my first pass. And I was like, I immediately ran over to the PX to get a slice of pizza because I'm a fat kid. And that's what I did on my first pass. And I actually saw the Twin Towers get hit on the news. I was shocked. I was like, how can people still be walking around? But for them, it was a month old, 2 months old. They had all seen it. It was just a shock. So now I graduated. And I was like, you know, basic training wasn't that bad. But I did find out one other thing. I realized I ended up becoming an NCO over time. So like I made an E5, which is a sergeant. And I knew at basic training I would be a terrible NCO because I have 2 left feet. I'm tone deaf, so I can't march and sing cadence. And I can't get mad about stuff that I really don't care about. And that seemed to be all NCOs did. It's like they got mad about stuff that didn't seem important, and they marched people around. Like, that was my experience with NCOs. So I was like, I need to become an officer because I hear they're lazy and they hang out inside. So I'm going to do that. My unit got alerted like 3 times and then turned down. And I either had to sign up with ROTC in college or I would miss my opportunity, basically, because you have to have so many years of service at the end of your contract or end of your time in school to sign up. So I was like, okay. I was like, I'll sign up. And then immediately after that, my unit got mobilized and I wasn't able to go because I was signed up with ROTC. So I felt pretty guilty about that. And I was like, okay, well, I made it to basic training, going through this officer stuff. I was like, what's the next hardest thing? People were like, oh, airborne school. Like, okay, all right, I'll go to airborne school. Now, I did drop like another 10 pounds when I got to college. And thank goodness I had gone to the military and understood how to, like, diet, do laundry, work out. And then that's why I got in with ROTC to begin with was that they had a workout program for the ROTC cadets 3 or 4 times a week. And I was like, I need somebody to go do this with to kind of stay in shape, keep me motivated. Otherwise, you know, I could just fall right back where I was before I went to basic training. So I ended up going there and I compete to go to airborne school. I was not even in the program at the time that I actually went. Primary military instructor, so the colonel that ran the program, you know, saw something in me that I didn't see. And I couldn't tell you at any time, you know, if I was better or worse than any of the other cadets. And he was just like, nope, you're going to go to airborne school. Finally went to airborne school. And I was like, that wasn't too bad. Now, I will also say I never want to jump out of a plane again after I got back. But some people are in airborne units because they love jumping. I'm in an airborne unit in spite of the fact that we jump. That's just me. So I get through ROTC and my unit's getting ready to mobilize. A brand new lieutenant. And And I was like, well, what's the next hardest course, you know? So I go to Ranger School, and now I had found out that Special Forces was in the National Guard, and I had tried out with a unit closest to where I was going to school. And I had kind of made it. I was in really good shape. Once again, both with Airborne School, Ranger School, going through Special Forces training, a lot of people talk about, like, positive affirmation. And I was like, not a bit of it. And I'll tell you, most of the guys that I think the world of that are just phenomenal soldiers no matter what they're in, a lot of Green Berets, I ask them, like, hey, man, how was your experience? And they were like, oh, I thought I was going to fail every day. And it's like, honestly, it's not the positive affirmation. It's the continuous fear of failure or not being good enough, but also trying that drove me to train harder, go further, and always think I was behind or I wasn't as good and to just do more. And so, like, that was kind of more of a motivational factor than every day being like, well, you're good enough. You're just fine. And then, you know, just settling. So I think that was a bigger driving factor. And so I went to Ranger School. I talk about the worst day. So everybody has a worst day of Ranger School, and it's like the day you want to quit. And if you don't quit on that day, you'll never have a harder day. And I will say I've never had a harder day in my life. We get ready to go out there. We're in Dahlonega, Georgia. It's end of February, early March. It had been snowing that night, and that morning we got ready to go to the mountains. It just started to, like, rain and freezing rain and sleet. And they drive you from the base camp out to the base of the mountains and the training area in these basically 20 people flatbed trucks with the like an army truck with a cover on top. Well, the windshield wipers weren't working on the truck that we had, so they got rid of that one and they just brought us a flatbed truck that looks like a tow truck you'd put a car on the back of after it stalls. And they were like, pile your rucksacks, your big bags down the middle, and then hold hands over top so you don't fall off, right? And it is just pouring rain at this point. It's freezing. It's below 20 degrees. And we're wearing summer uniform. You don't wear any weather gear. You don't wear any winter gear. You get one set of hat and gloves, and you don't want to get them wet, so you never wear them in the rain. And they drive us to the top. And then immediately when the truck stops, we get attacked, you know. So they're like, run, you know, artillery. And then, of course, you have like an 80-pound backpack on trying to run up a mountain. So it's like you kind of Scooby-Doo it, you know. Your legs are kind of moving, but you're not really going anywhere, you know. Like, and so we just kind of slowly walk up this mountain. My guys, my platoon did like everything wrong. Like, we didn't do a short haul to recon the objective. They just walked right up the mountain, right down the other side, stopped to put everybody's, you know, backpacks in a pile. And then they put us out on this ambush line. Not only were we early, but the other unit was late. And so until they do their mission, like, our mission wasn't going to go off. And you're trying to basically do this ambush. And the rain had stopped, and I was carrying a squad automatic weapon. So I had this machine gun. They put me on right side security, and they laid me down behind this big tree. And the minute I laid down, I, like, broke through the ice, and I was, like, laying in a puddle. Went to adjust myself to get out of this puddle, even though it was, like, the perfect spot behind this giant tree. And I just heard this instructor behind me. He's like, Ranger, you trying to get out from behind cover? And I was like, no. And so I just laid there. I remember, like, while I was laying there, I finally realized that my hand had frozen to the front of the rifle. Like, it had frozen to the metal, and I was covered in ice. And I had been there for, I mean, hours. Felt like hours. I know it had been like 2 or 3 hours. I looked at my watch. I said, all right, 10 minutes, I'm going to quit. Like, this is it. Like, I'm not going any further. And about 5 minutes later, I'd look at my watch and I'd be like, all right, in 10 minutes, I'm going to quit. About 5 minutes later, I'd say, okay, in 10 minutes, I'm going to quit. I did that for about another hour. And then I looked at my watch and I was like, all right, God, in 3 minutes, I'm just going to make noise so somebody comes and gets me, because, like, I am frozen. And at that point, I heard one shot go off. And I don't know if it was somebody who had, like, a negligent discharge or if they actually shot at something. And I put 200 rounds of belt-fed ammunition through that machine gun as, like, fast as it would go. And I was just like, all right, we're doing it. You know, like, whatever we just shot at, let's ambush that thing. I noticed that the brass was steaming next to me because it was so much hotter than the air around it. And I was like, oh, and I put my face down in it. And I was like, oh, it's warm. And then I heard the platoon leader. He's like, assault, assault. And I was like, oh, okay, I get up and move. And I go to run across the road. My legs were so frozen. And because you're in the mountains, there's like a little cut before you have to, like, step down onto the road. And I biff it. I completely fall flat on my face on this road because my legs are asleep and they're frozen. I drop the machine gun. It goes, like, skidding off the road. I gotta go get this thing, and, you know, it's partially tied to me. And I was like, oh man, I feel so warm. Like, I've never been so warm in my life because I finally got to move. Turns out, I was like, yeah, no day will ever be worse than today. Now, the other thing I said was, it's like, I will never go out for Special Forces because I will never be tired, cold, wet, and hungry again. Never again. In the Army, it's like, we use the term HUA, you know, and I like use HUA like a fuel, right? So it's like, I think everybody's born with a certain amount of it. And then the more you're tortured or more schools you go to or the more BS you have to put up with, you got to spend a little bit. Like, the older you get. And I was like, nah, my tank's done. I got no more left. No more schools in me. I was selected to go to the Army Reconnaissance Course. I went to that and had a great time. They do another super professional school. went to Mountain Warfare, a couple other ones, all really well-run courses. Learned a lot, but I also got awarded a 19 Charlie MOS. So, like, at this point, I have now been field artillery, infantry, and armor MOS. So I'm all the combat arms. So all the skills you cannot use to get a civilian career as a civilian soldier. And now I'll tell people, like, going to selection for special forces, it's either something that you want to do or it's something you have to do. And for me, it's something I had to do because the stars will never align perfectly that you have a chance to take a year off of your life to go do this. And usually it's like, hey, my finances aren't in order. My family life's not in order. I'm not in good enough shape. My civilian career is not perfect. And so it's like there's always these things where it's not going to work out. And the thing that I had learned was it's better to try and fail than never to try at all. So it's like that stuff doesn't matter. I got the one piece I need to have locked in, which is I have a supporting family member. The rest of the stuff doesn't matter. I'm going to go. So, of course, just like the idiot I was going to Ranger School in the winter, I went to selection in the winter. And it was like one of the coldest Decembers on record for North Carolina. And I remember like it was so cold that so you have two quart canteens that you carry on your backpack. And then you have one quart canteens that you carry on your combat load. And it had all frozen. Like my two quarts froze during land nav and my one quart. So it's just like, yep, no water for the next 12 hours. All right, no problem. I can do this. And once again, the whole time, self-doubt, you're not doing well enough. You're slow. You know, you're behind time. And then come to find out, I got selected. Couldn't believe it. So the statistics generally work out that of 50% who go to selection, only 50% make it. Of the 50% selected, only 50% ever start the Special Forces qualification course. And of the 50% that start, only 50 make it through the whole training for whatever reason. So if you think about it, if selection has 400 people, 200 people get selected. Of those 200, only 100 ever really go to the training for Special Forces. Of that 100 that start, only 50 make it through the completion of the course. I count myself very lucky. You know, I've been blessed with the soldiers around me, just good attitudes, the NCOs I've been around. The Army's provided me the opportunities to do the things that most Americans think about. You know, I take the kids to Disneyland, I live in a nice house, I feel very secure. But the real thing that it taught me was you don't really grow up, no matter how old you are, until you start to take responsibility for yourself and your actions. That's the level of maturity. There's people who are in their 30s who still can't do that. One thing that the National Guard or joining the military really helps you do is realize, like, you got to take responsibility for yourself, and then you're ready to help take responsibility for your team, squad, company. And I think those are important lessons.
What is the next hardest thing for Eric? According to him, it's taking leadership and being in charge of soldiers, something that he's very passionate about. Altogether, this is an awesome story. A directionless fat kid turning himself to a bona fide Special Forces badass. But what I think makes his story so unique is just how down to earth and honest he is about his struggles, his self-doubt, his anxiety, you know, all the normal stuff that everyone deals with every day. I asked him for his advice on how he overcomes his struggles.
But no, I would say, well, people who know me well will always pick on me because I'll be like, and I'm always fat, right? So, like, because I have, like, this body dysmorphia. I still see the 17-year-old kid that lost 65 pounds between getting ready for basic training and basic training. And so, you know, it's like that's the person I still see when I look in the mirror. I'm just very happy that I'm surrounded by people who see something more, you know. And everybody should realize that. There are those people out there that think a lot of you. So don't doubt other people's opinion of you. You can hate yourself as much as you can. As long as it's for self-improvement purposes only. You know, that's probably not the best thing to follow the resiliency podcast. But it's okay to have self-doubt as long as you do something about it. You know, if you're not happy with some part of your life, it's not going to get better waiting for someone else to come along and fix it. You have to start the journey. Yeah. And whether it's one step at a time, whether it's a fitness goal, whether it's a career goal, figure out what it takes to be put in that position. You know, I read it in a really good book, so I'll say it. This guy pointed out, he's like, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a rock star until I realized that I wasn't practicing the guitar 80 hours a week. I just like the idea and the lifestyle. So figure out what you really want to do, and that's where you invest your time. Because where you invest your time is where you invest your life.
Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Your story is unbelievable, and I feel like there's something that all of us can find to take away from this story of somebody who's going from overweight, not able to join, to now Special Forces. I mean, Sergeant Hearn, this is incredible.
I think it was a great story. I think people can take away a lot from this.
The transparency of what he shares with us is just very admirable for someone to speak so openly about what they've experienced and not solely talking on the military agenda.
And I really like that, you know, he comes off as such a normal guy, because this shows that anybody could do this as long as they had the right mindset, the right mentors, and really push themselves to get it. Now, speaking of constant changes and fluctuations in the military and life and leadership is the Alabama National Guard Adjutant General, Brigadier General David Pritchett.
So, born and raised in a little town just north of Birmingham, Mount Olive, Alabama.
That's where I live. I moved here less than a year ago, 9 months ago, and I purchased a home in Mount Olive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I grew up in Mount Olive. I went to Gardendale High School, mm-hmm. and then eventually went to Auburn. Met my wife after I graduated from Auburn, and really thought that was where we'd spend the rest of our time in Alabama. And we built our forever house. I've learned, don't ever say you are in your forever house, because you know, we're three houses removed from that now. So anyway, I'm an Alabama Guardsman and spent 30 years in the Alabama Guard before I left for a few years. So shortly after graduating from Auburn University, my first job out of college was working for a technology company out of Auburn, Alabama. It was they did several things, but they were very focused on higher education technology, and so I worked for that company for about 7 years before being hired by another small startup higher education technology company. Worked for them for almost 15 years and was hired by one of the larger higher education technologies in the world, and worked for them for, you know, approximately 5 or 6 years after that. And that was certainly the most demanding job I had, because, and I just had to spend most of my time on the road. So a typical week would be, I'd get back from drill on a Sunday evening, I'd get on an airplane on Monday, and I'd come home on either Thursday or Friday. And then oftentimes, you know, at the time, in 2018, when I started the Title 10 position, you know, I was a brigade commander at 62nd Troop Command. So, you know, with those units, often they were drilling separate weekends. So oftentimes, you know, I would be away on multiple weekends just visiting the soldiers. So it just really became untenable to keep that same schedule up. And so someone had mentioned to me, well, you know, Fort Sill is advertising for a Senior Army National Guard Advisor. You know, why don't you put a packet in, which I did, and a few months later I was selected for that role, and that's what ultimately took us to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for 3 years.
So when you made that move to Oklahoma for your family, did it end up working out that way, or were things different than you expected?
So they were, I mean, things are never exactly like you kind of paint that picture in your mind. And really before we even moved, a conversation I had with my wife was she was like, well, what's Fort Sill, what's Lawton, Oklahoma like? And I'm like, well, you know, it's, even though it's really not the Southeast, it's widely considered to be the South still, and the people are very much like folks here in Alabama. The weather is pretty similar, and so we get off the airplane in the middle of July, and it's 115 degrees, and she looks at me and she says, this is not like Alabama. But to your question, I think all of us, you know, gained a lot of experiences we obviously would have never had we not left Alabama to go out there for 3 years. Was it exactly like we expected? No, but we certainly learned a lot. And I would say that my experience there at Fort Sill for 3 years was pivotal for this role, because, you know, our both the Air Force and the Army specifically, when I was serving there. We're in the middle of our modernization, and so that was largely what I focused on, was how we're transforming our Army to the Army of 2030 and building or planning for the Army of 2040. So that was, you know, definitely relevant experience that helps. Here's this role, is the tag now of Alabama.
I like that you started talking about moving up to the Army of 2030, prepare for the Army of 2040. You know, with you being in the Army for 30 years, I wanted to ask, what's your common observations been?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, things haven't, on one front, they haven't changed. I mean, and I've seen, you know, with the career I've had, I've seen a number of different weapon systems, and I've seen the different technology. But obviously, the one thing that's remained constant is the soldiers are still soldiers. Now, you know, from my foxhole now, they're a lot younger than they were, you know, when I first got in, obviously, because I'm now been in for a number of years. But soldiers are still soldiers, and from a leadership perspective, it's really all still about leadership, and it's about taking care of those soldiers. What has changed, you know, again, I go back to the example of my own kids. It's really different now that, you know, we're all walking around with devices in our hands, and you have the power of having all this information at your fingertips, that you can get information on almost anything, and you can share information real time almost anywhere in the world as long as you have a cell signal. That's good and bad. You know, it certainly opens up the aperture for our soldiers to be more knowledgeable and have access to that knowledge. We can see in Ukraine with the Russian-Ukraine conflict of how deadly it can be. So that will be our challenge going forward if we're in a large-scale combat operation with our soldiers and airmen. You know, how do you incorporate policies that, you know, protects the individuals and your organizations with cell phones? Because we're all used, even me, 55 years old, I'm still used to having, look, I got two of them in my hand right now. So so we're all used to that information right at our fingertips.
What are some changes that you think, you know, our soldiers and really the citizens of Alabama can expect to see within the next coming, you know, couple of years and the decade to follow with the Guard?
Well, I think our biggest challenge will be, aside from, and I've touched on it already, so I won't go back to the personal devices and the cell phones. That's a challenge for leadership. But I think in general, just the technology and the speed at which we will have to make decisions on the future battlefield, and I think that is going to be a critical thing. And so, you know, we talk now about multi-domain operations, and, you know, the soldiers and the leadership and the airmen as well, as they transition to large-scale operations too. I think, you know, the soldiers and airmen just have to be better critical thinkers, and they have to make split-second decisions, because of those decisions could be the difference in life and death for not only yourself, but, you know, the other folks on your team. So I think the great thing is that, you know, we have a great organization. I think we have the resources. Strategic changes in our formations will obviously be out there for the citizens to see, probably more prevalent on the Air Guard side than on the Army side, just based on, you know, the fact that our Army formations are spread all over the state and they're not concentrated. So the citizen may not see, the Alabama citizen may not notice as much on those transformational things going on the Army side, but, you know, they're definitely happening. And so our systems and the equipment that our soldiers are undergoing out there is, it's a real thing and happening every day. My concern, and this is one of the things that I expressed with the governor's staff, is if you look at our national debt and you look at what our military is gonna be asked to do potentially in the future, I think we're in for some knife fights out there when it comes to budgeting. And so, you know, I am all in on doing everything I can to make sure that the soldiers and the airmen and the Alabama National Guard remain best equipped, best trained, and ready to go and fight and win our nation's wars if called upon, as well as be prepared here for anything that might happen in the homeland. And the other thing I would note about that is that I think you'll see in the next large combat or conflict, I should say, it's going to get really blurry between what's homeland defense and what's large-scale operations, because, you know, we know that our adversaries, you know, whether you're talking China or Russia or even the North Koreans or Iran, we're being attacked today by our adversaries, not kinetically, but through information operations and through cyber, generally gray zone areas. But so again, I think, you know, it's a blurry line between what's really homeland defense and what's actual combat, mm-hmm. you know, so I think what we can do organizationally is just make sure our men and women are prepared for that next conflict, and hopefully it never comes.
You know, I'm going on 10, 11 years at this point, and I would say most of my career is M-Day, and I'd say up until like the past couple of years, you know, taking a higher leadership role as an E6 and coming to this tech position, really the leadership above my unit never really concerned me.
Yeah.
You know, but getting to a point now where I'm like, well, this really does matter, and you should know who your leaders are, and either, you know, have some sort of opinion on them, so you know, so you can make decisions of what you're going to do in the future. Never even think about Joint Force Headquarters and who's the tag and what that really means for them.
Yeah, I don't, you know, if I think back, I don't know when I ever started paying attention to who the tag was, but it was. It was well into my career, right? And you may have seen them every now and then, or maybe they, if you're lucky, they came to your AT. But you know, it's a little different. You know, I think the good thing about the military in general, you know, you've seen a dynamic change in the style of leadership from, and you heard my predecessor talk about it a lot. But I would say before servant leadership was a thing and all the people in business write about it now, that's always been my style, you know, and it was always part of my command philosophies. Now, at this level, you don't really write command philosophies, but, you know, if you're not willing to get out there as a battery commander, it's a little bit harder as a battalion commander, but if you're not willing to get out there and do PMCS and change the oil on the Humvees or to, you know, in the artillery world, punch the tubes after you finish firing on a weekend, and, you know, soldiers pay attention to that. And if you think you're above that, then they pick up on it pretty quick. Yeah. And now, most, you know, when you get to certain leadership positions, you just don't have time to do a lot of that. But I still think it's important to get out. And what you can still do is you can put a rucksack on and you can go ruck march with the infantry guys, or, you know, you can lay down in the dirt and, you know, qualify and those kind of things, you know. You know, fitness, ACFT, it's a big deal to me. And, you know, the day that I can't do the ACFT and I can't, you know, do what I'm asking the soldiers to do is the day it's time for me to get out. Because that's, you know, that's just my leadership philosophy. You have to lead from the front at all levels.
We've talked a lot about leadership with some of the other people we've interviewed this week. And, you know, having to have trust in your leadership. And I think, you know, it's one of the better parts of the National Guard is you get to take the uniform off, you get to go home, you get to be with your family more often than, you know, maybe our active duty counterparts. But I think you really have to have that trust in the National Guard, because, you know, if you've been at home with your family all week and, you know, you're making all this money on the side, you know, with your, you know, maybe your career, you have to really have that trust to say, yeah, I have to walk away from this for, you know, a couple weeks, mm-hmm. couple of months, a year for a deployment. And if you don't have that trust in your leadership, I feel like that's what can hurt retention and keeping people in. Because if I don't like my leaders, why would I go out into the field when I could probably just stay home at the house?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, Alabama's doing some really good things. And I'm not trying to take away from our recruiting and retention battalion on the Army Guard side, because they're doing a really phenomenal job. They are leading the country right now. So I would hope that, you know, 10 years from now, for the young soldiers that may still be in the formations, that, you know, that they would say that, you know, when General Pritchett left, you know, we were the best equipped, the best trained, and the best taken care of that we've ever had. So, you know, and that kind of gets into really outlining my priorities. So, no different from what you'll hear the Army say. You know, I think there's something to the people first thing. So if you're not taking care of your people, both the soldiers, the airmen, their families, and also our civilian workers, that's the state and our federal workers, and it all starts with that. So if you can't get that right, then it doesn't matter how good your equipment is, because you're not going to have soldiers and airmen to fly your F-35s or to drive your Humvees or, you know, whatever the equipment is. So it all starts there. And then, you know, I think if you take care of your people, again, that puts you in a position to get the best formations and the best equipment. And then you have the funding to train them. And then, you know, and so it all starts there and it all builds up. But that's where it all starts, is your people. So I hope that 10 years from now that, you know, our service members would say, well, he took care of us and he took care of our families and the civilians that worked in our formations as well, because we oftentimes forget about, yeah, we have uniforms on, but there's a lot of civilians that work in this building and our other facilities that help us do what we do. And so they all fit into that as part of the total picture.
We just want to say a big thank you to everyone who took the time to come talk with us on our podcast, and also to Staff Sergeant Thomas Furlow for doing all of the music for this episode.
And I would also like to give a shout out to our boss, Mr. Mac Muzio. Without him, none of this would have been possible. You know, I've been doing this job for about a year, and when I first met Mac, I was a little afraid just because I thought he might have been one of those...
He was like a little snivelly guy, and he had big glasses. He's like, all right, guys.
But it turns out he's not, so... That's great.
That is a plus.
It is a plus. But until this next time, thank you for listening to AGR.
Alabama Guard Radio.